Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Maybe you found that reading long articles or a book has become difficult. You just can't stick with it. Perhaps you or your children can no longer sit through an entire movie without picking up your phone or simply moving on to something else. Possibly you've been working hard to get something done. You're on a deadline. You just can't focus. You flit from one thing vying for your attention to another, all while trying to accomplish that one all-important task. Well, you're not alone. Our attention spans are shorter than they once were. Some might say they're shot. Just a short time ago, back in 2004, you remember 2004, don't you? We averaged about 2.5 minutes spent on a task before moving on to something else. Well, today, in our screen-dominated world where we are constantly being bombarded by texts, phone calls, emails, notifications of every stripe, we now spend 47 seconds on one thing before moving on to something else. And no, you can't multitask. So what can be done? Well, our guest this hour has been studying how technology has been stealing our attention, and she says what we think we know is wrong. She also has some suggestions on how to fight back and how to best function in this digital world. Dr. Gloria Mark is Chancellor's Professor of Informatics at the University of California, Irvine. She has been a research scientist at Microsoft and the German National Research Center for Information Technology and is a 2-time recipient of the Google Research Award and, in her spare time, has written the book Attention Span, Find Focus, Fight Distraction, A Groundbreaking Way to Restore Balance, Happiness, and Productivity. And to that end, she joins us for the hour from California, where it's very early in the morning. I hope I have your attention. Good morning. Welcome.
You do. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I wasn't going to start here, but we just were talking about this before we went on the air and how you got into this business. You are a trained artist, and you were going to be an artist. And now you find yourself in informatics, which is, I can't think of a field more farther afield than that. How? Why?
I like to make changes. So, yeah, I never thought I would do anything except art. You know, I was very young. I was very passionate. And then I discovered the reality of how hard it was to make a living. And I had one fellow student after graduation who was so gifted in art, became an elevator operator. Mm-hmm. And then another friend of mine who was really talented, she announced to me that she was going to study dental hygiene, which is a great profession, but you don't need to study art in order to go in, you know, to become a dental hygienist. So I thought, there's a lot of other things I can do. And one of the things I was able to do was math. So I thought, maybe I can find something in math. And maybe to make a long story short, I did end up at University of Michigan in a math-related field and applied for a job as a research assistant. You know, I didn't have a lot of money and I needed a job. Mm-hmm. So I went to Dr. Manfred Cochin, who was advertising for someone to help him in a field called information science. I had no clue what that was. I had just come out of an art degree. So we sat down for the interview and he asked me, can I code? No. Do I know network theory? No. Fuzzy set theory? No. And so I just grabbed my backpack and started to walk out and thanked him. And he said, to his credit, and it changed my life, he said, wait a minute, stop. What can you do? And I said, I can paint, I could draw. And then he said, come back and sit down. And he told me before he got his PhD at MIT, He studied at the Art Students League in New York, and we had this really, really wonderful conversation about 2 hours, just about art. And then he said, you know, I have this grant to study the discovery process. And do you think you could do that and study the discovery process of artists? And being very young and naive, not knowing really very much at all about this field, I said, of course I can. I knew how artists made discoveries. I just had to figure out how to write about it. And he hired me. He said, you know, research is a risk. It's really a risk, but I'm going to take a risk with you. And he gave me a chance. And I began to read cognitive psychology because I had to figure out how to put into words the experience that I had as an artist. And, you know, I ended up writing a paper that got accepted, and that changed the course of my life. And I ended up getting a PhD in psychology.
As you point out, art is about discovery. It's about the artist discovering a lot. Whether if you're an actor, you're discovering who the character is, what their relationships to other characters in the piece are. If you're a visual artist, I guess when you start with a blank canvas, you're discovering as you go along what it's going to be and how you're going to make it so. But it also strikes me that as a visual artist, somebody who paints and draws, you're doing that in a relatively solo manner. You're probably by yourself, holed up in a studio, maybe a radio or a CD player or something playing music is on in the background to inspire you or to get you into the zone of all of this, with very few interruptions. So when you went into an office, because you did a lot of research in offices, some groundbreaking ways to do this research a long time ago before it had been automated, and watched how people work and how they interface with their stuff, their machines, it must have shocked you, the number of interruptions that people faced.
It actually didn't, because I had experienced that myself. I had experienced how often I was interrupting myself. And I decided I wanted to study, is this widespread? Is it just me? Or are other people having this experience as well? And so it wasn't as shocking as one might think, because, you know, I noticed as, you know, I got my first academic job in the year 2000. And by that time, the web was, you know, reaching the height of popularity. And I noticed it was very hard for me to stay away from my computer, but at the same time, it was very hard for me to stay on any single screen. I kept flipping from screen to screen, checking email. We didn't have social media back then, but I just was getting myself pretty exhausted and wondering, am I the only one, or are other people experiencing this?
So let's talk a little bit about the progression of this, because you're right. I mean, I remember one day, shortly after I got something better than dial-up connection to the internet, sitting down on a Saturday when I had nothing to do and just surfing the web. And I looked up, it was like 9 o'clock in the morning, and I looked up and it was dark. Literally, it was dark. I hadn't had lunch. It was at 6 o'clock at night. And I'm thinking, what have you done? You've gone down the rabbit hole and you accomplished absolutely nothing, just surfing. That was before all the dings and notifications. That was before smartphones, which are even, I think, more destructive or more disruptive, let's put it that way. What do you think, computers or smartphones? Which is the worst culprit here?
Well, you know, with smartphones, it's anytime, anywhere. So your interruptions can happen literally anywhere. If you don't turn it off in the movies, people are going to get very annoyed. Many people check their phones during the night. So I would say smartphones. Now, of course, if you're a knowledge worker of any kind, you're sitting in front of your computer for, you know, a number of hours. And of course, you have the opportunity for interruptions then.
And I guess the question is why? Why can't we? It's just a device that dings. Why can't we ignore it? Why are we attracted to it like a fly to sugar? I mean, it's you can't. It goes off, and I have to look.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons behind that. So of course there is habit. There's a type of attention that's automatic. And when things are blinking and flashing, we just can't help but respond to them. And, you know, this actually goes back to our evolutionary past, when people were hunters and gatherers. And when people were gatherers, they had to scan the environment and look for predators and danger signals. And so, you know, we've evolved to respond to these kinds of dings and notifications that we get on our phones and computers. But, you know, it also turns out that we are just as likely to interrupt ourselves. So about 49% of the time, we interrupt ourselves. We don't need a ding or any kind of visual notification.
I want to talk more about that, because I always thought that was just me being a procrastinator, but maybe there's more to it than that. But if we do ignore these dings, I understand that ignoring them also, if answering them causes us fatigue and anxiety because we're not getting our work done, ignoring them also increases our anxiety level. Why?
Well, there's a very interesting psychology study that goes back to the 1920s. And this was done by a woman named Bluma Zeigarnik. And she's very under-recognized and underappreciated, but her work has pretty much laid a solid foundation for understanding interruptions. And she found that, this was back in 1927, that when people were interrupted in doing things, they tended to remember them better than when they finished tasks. Why? Because when you interrupt something, it creates tension in you. And you have this, and the longer that you go without going back to that interrupted task, the greater and greater this tension is. So, you know, we're humans, and we if we don't finish something, it stays in our mind, it lingers, it's on the back burner of our minds. And so imagine during the day, you've got one unfinished task, and then you start looking at an email, leave it. And then you start working on something else and leave it. You start a post on social media, don't finish it. You're always switching and leaving all these things interrupted and unfinished, and that tension just builds up in us.
So you open your book, Attention Span, writing about all these digital distractions that we've been talking about. And we begin facing these at the very beginning of our workday when we sit down to start on a project, only to have to take some phone calls or answer voicemail messages or respond to emails. The fact that this stuff is instant communication, and if it's coming from your boss, you feel like you have to respond immediately because that proves that you're on the job, you're working, you're not ignoring them. And already at the start of the day, you start feeling tired. Well, I'm old enough, and so are you, I guess, to remember a time before computers, when maybe you had an office job and your boss came in, or your coworkers came in, or if you were a manager, somebody came in and asked for direction, and it went all day long, and the phone rang all day. So when we come back from the break, I want to ask you, what's the difference? We dealt with it then. We're dealing with it now electronically. What's the difference? Our guest is Dr. Gloria Mark, Chancellor's Professor of Economics at UNC, at University of California, Irvine. Attention Span, Find Focus, Fight Distraction is her book. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about our dwindling attention spans and why the impact of technology on those on that attention span and what you can do to fix it, because it makes us anxious and tired and frustrated. There's a book about this from our guest today, Gloria Mark, called Attention Span, Find Focus, Fight Distraction, A Groundbreaking Way to Restore Balance, Happiness, and Productivity. We'll get to some of those solutions a little bit later on. But talk about what I asked you just before the break, and that was the fact that, yeah, we have all these things vying for our attention, but we did before computers. We did before smartphones. Maybe slower, but we did. So what's the difference?
Well, there's a lot of difference. One of the things is that we've got way more sources of interruptions. So it's not just a colleague coming in or the phone call, but we're sitting in front of the world's largest candy store. So we have this urge to go into that candy store and satisfy the slightest whim that we have. And the another really big change agent was email. Right? So we didn't have email back then. And email is the biggest source of interruptions, according to the people who I study. There's, of course, Slack as well. And so electronic communications really makes our interruptions a lot worse.
And not everybody has to deal with these programs like Microsoft Teams, and there are others. Google has its own version of it, and I suppose Apple does too, but it allows you to collaborate in real time with your colleagues across the multiverse, and you could be working on something and suddenly all these people on the Teams are bombarding you with stuff that has to be attended to. Are we ever going to get a handle on this? I mean, are we going to look back on this, or our children or their children's children going to look back on this as a time when we were just struggling to figure it all out, but they have figured it out?
I do think so. So I am an optimist that we are going to be able to figure this out. You know, when you think about it, we're still in the Wild West of computing, right? The web has, it only reached popularity in the mid 90s. It's younger than the fall of the Berlin Wall. So it's pretty recent in human history. And, you know, what we really need to understand is how we can better integrate technology into our lives without us getting overwhelmed by it. And so, you know, we have teams of engineers and computer scientists who are designing technology without quite understanding how people are going to use this technology in their lives. So there's a lot of unintended consequences that we're seeing when technology is delivered to us.
Yeah.
For example, social media, of course, there are many benefits with social media. We can connect to other people, but who would have thought there would be unintended consequences, right, such as cyberbullying, misinformation, and so on?
Right. You brought up how young our association with the internet is, and I had forgotten that, quite frankly. And it's on page 18 of your book. And when I read it, I thought, oh my, this is, wow, we're dealing with this pretty well, all things considered. The internet, you say, began widely being used less than 30 years ago. We often forget that our digital lives are still quite young, younger than the fall of the Berlin Wall, the formation of the European Union, and when HIV/AIDS was first identified. And that seems like 100 years ago, but it isn't. It's just a while ago. So all these distractions that are causing us problems at work continue into our personal lives because we carry these phones everywhere we go now. What kind of an impact, what kind of an influence are these interruptions having on real life outside the office?
Yeah, they interrupt conversations. They interrupt people's experiences, even when people are walking. You know, I'm still astounded when I see how often it is that people, they're walking in beautiful environments. They might be in nature and looking at their cell phones. Attention is very goal directed. And if you're using your attention and trying to text and you're in the middle of a beautiful garden, right, your goal is on that text as opposed to enjoying the surroundings.
And this is a totally different thing, but because we all have cameras in these phones, it astounds me that people enjoy events through the screen on their camera rather than in the moment. They have to have a video recording of it. And I always wonder, do they ever watch these videos later on? Or are they just capturing them for posterity? Who knows? You write about the unbreakable bonds that we have developed with computers and smartphones, along with the ubiquity of these devices and the price that we pay for trying to keep up with the onslaught of information that they provide. You also say that technology can no longer be disconnected from who we are. You say we mutually influence each other, but it appears, I think, given the thesis of your book, that our lives have come to be in technology's control, not ours. Is that correct?
Well, I would say it's not quite correct. I would say it's not that technology completely controls us. It's got a big impact on us. Controls part of our lives, but I still feel that people have some degree of control, but I really think we need to have a lot more control. I'm not a doomsday sayer where I believe that, you know, this is it, technology is taking over the world. I don't believe that at all. I do believe that humans can still take back and get control of our lives with technology.
But the fact that we are now, I guess, no longer able to disconnect technology from our lives, it's here to stay and it's part of our lives and we're going to have to learn how to deal with it. But you say the result is a striking change in how our minds focus on information and made us less able to pay attention. What's the most striking thing about that?
Well, it's what you mentioned earlier, the fact that people's attention on any screen we discover was averaging 47 seconds, which is really quite short. If you look at the median means the midpoint of observations. The median was 40 seconds. That means half of all the observations we saw with people's attention on a screen was 40 seconds or less. And this kind of dynamic attention, I call kinetic attention, because it's dynamic and people just don't focus attention for lengthy periods of time, at least quite a bit of the time that they're on their computers.
So if we're being bombarded moment by moment by a never-ending stream of information that we feel compelled to consume, or to at least to begin reading, we can't read it all in 40 seconds. So are we just wasting our time? Are we learning anything? Are we getting anything out of this aside from the dopamine fix that comes with ding, oh, something new?
We are learning things, but we're just getting ourselves exhausted, because every time you switch your attention, it drains these precious and limited mental resources that humans have. And when you have constant switching, it's also constant draining of resources that we should in fact be using toward the work we want to do or the reading we want to do.
So let's not lay it all at the feet of technology, because as you said a moment ago, it isn't just technology that diverts our attention, it is us. You studied this, and it turns out, you say, that people are nearly as likely to switch their attention of their own volition. We are determined, you say, to be interrupted, if not by others, then by ourselves. So if we've always done this, is this just because we get bored and distracted and we're procrastinating and we don't want to do that right now? Let's go over here and look at that for a second. Are we spending more time doing that? How would you calculate the difference?
Yeah, I mean, it's all of the things you're saying. So we might have an urge to look up information. A thought pops into your head. And because you can find it within milliseconds, we do, right? All you have to do is at your fingertips, go into the web and find the answer to whatever this question is that popped into your head. We may have a memory of something we need to do. I talked about the experiment that Bluma-Zeigarnik did, where we remember interrupted tasks. And of course, this nags at us. We have tension. We have to go back and finish this. And of course, people like to do things that make them happy, dopamine hits. So there's all of these reasons are behind what leads us to self-interrupt.
Not only did you discover that we interrupt ourselves, you discovered in the course of your research, as you sat behind people at work and observed them with a stopwatch, timing how long they spent on any one task before they moved on to something else, that when you reduce the number of outside interruptions a person is experiencing, either by silencing your dings or shutting down your email program for 30 minutes while you try to work, etc., that when you remove those distractions, we come up with our own. Why?
That's right. That's right. I believe that people are just determined to have to be interrupted and have short attention spans. We're conditioned. And you're right. When the external interruptions from things like notifications or chimes from your phone, when those reduced, our self-interruptions increased. And it's, you know, it's how we maintain these short attention spans. We're used to it. We're conditioned. And that's how it's become.
Did we always do that? Did we always interrupt ourselves? Or do you know? Because I guess your research began after the internet. What do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, no one else has actually looked at this. So we can't compare. We first started looking at this in 2004. With the stopwatches that you mentioned. We later switched to computer logging techniques, which mm-hmm. is automatic. So we didn't have to follow people around. It was very labor intensive, I have to say. But we don't know. We don't know if people were always this way. I suspect very strongly that of course people would self-interrupt, but I don't believe it was to the extent that they do now.
If these interruptions that are caused by technology are making us frustrated, fatigued, and raising our blood pressure and stress levels, are the self-induced interruptions, the one that we choose to do on our own with no outside source, are they doing the same thing?
They are, because every time you switch attention, you have to reorient to that new activity. So if I'm trying to get some work done and I'm, let's say, writing, and then I suddenly switch to email or I switch to Slack. And I switch of my own accord. You know, I'm not getting a notification, but I decide to switch. Yes, that's also getting me exhausted, because this tank of mental resources that I have is just dripping away.
So if we're experiencing all the things that you write about, and we are, I think there's no denying the fact that we are constantly interrupted, and it can be very frustrating, particularly if you have a job to do on a deadline like I do every day, these interruptions can be anxiety producing. Why? Here's the million-dollar question. Why have we chosen to take all of this that we face in the office every day, why have we chosen to take it home with us, with smartphones and our own personal computers always taking our attention away?
Yeah. So, you know, of course there is habit, but we also we're social beings, and we seek social rewards. We trade in what's called social capital. And social capital means the exchange of favors with other people. So I'm going to answer your email because I expect you're going to answer mine. And so people want to maintain a good balance of social capital with their colleagues, with their manager, with their friends. And so when people go home, right, and your colleague sends you an email or your colleague sends you a Slack message, we want to respond to that because we want to have that social capital account stay in good balance. And so And of course, people know that if they send a message, they'll get a response, and so they keep doing it. And we're all caught up in this web of we are interconnected in an electronic web of communications, and it's hard to break out of that.
Well, you spend time in this book, Attention Span, exploding four myths that you believe have developed around our use of technology and the distractions that that creates. And as you go through some of them, you kind of cut us a break, which I was pleased to see because I was feeling very guilty about this. For instance, you say that the first myth is the feeling that we should strive to be focused when on our devices, our computers, etc., so that we can be productive. And you say it's a myth that we shouldn't feel guilty if we can't focus. Explain that.
Yeah, so we can't focus for lengthy periods of time. Humans can't. In the same way that we can't lift weights all day without getting exhausted. Again, it goes back to people have this limited capacity of mental resources, your attentional capacity, and you just can't expend that for lengthy periods of time. You need to have a meaningful break. And there are times in the day where people are at their peak of attention and other times when we're in a trough. And when we're in a trough, that's not the time you should be doing hard work. It's the time you should pull back, take a meaningful break, get yourself replenished. So this notion, there's this narrative that we need to schedule tasks back to back and try to pack everything in as much as we can. It's just not possible, and it's not healthy for humans to do that. So we need to rethink, we need to reframe how we think about using technology from, instead of the main goal being as productive as possible, to the main goal, keeping our well-being, because if we keep our well-being, we will be productive.
You write that it is a myth that the distractions, interruptions, and multitasking we experience while on our devices are due primarily to the notifications we receive and to our own lack of discipline. I have about 15 seconds. What's the truth if that's the myth?
The truth is there are many reasons behind it. There's our social natures, there's personality differences. The design of the web mimics how human memory is organized, and this distracts us as well.
Dr. Gloria Mark, a professor of informatics at University of California, Irvine. Her book is called Attention Span. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Gloria Mark is with us, Chancellor's Professor of Informatics at the University of California, Irvine, where she is this morning. It's very early there. We thank her for getting up and paying attention, because it's working. Her book is called Attention Span, Find Focus, Fight Distraction, A Groundbreaking Way to Restore Balance, Happiness, and Productivity, and we'll get to that in a second. One of your findings, as you studied all this over the last several decades, is that it takes, when we are distracted and we move on to something else, it takes about 25 minutes to regain focus after an interruption. Do you think that if people read this book and find out about that, even through this conversation, that they'll be less apt to succumb to these interruptions, knowing that they're decreasing their productivity and increasing their frustration?
It's not easy to change. And, people have to really be intentional about wanting to change. And I believe people can change, and people can get agency over their lives. But it requires, definitely people have to be motivated to want to do that.
So let's talk for a moment about multitasking. We think we can do it. I've been told by other experts that's absolutely impossible to do it. There's no such thing. We can, however, walk and chew gum at the same time. That's multitasking, but it's unconscious multitasking. So does that mean that we can effectively concentrate on two work tasks at the same time? But what does it mean? We can't concentrate on two work tasks at the same time because they both need concentration and awareness, right?
That's right. We can't. It's not humanly possible. So we have what's called controlled attention, where you really put effort into doing something. So when you're reading, you put in the effort, even when you're doing email, that requires effort. We also have automatic attention. And that's where you don't put in any effort at all, like when you walk, when you chew gum, when you drive, right? So if one of the tasks we're doing requires some kind of effort, we can do it as long as the other task is automatic. That's why you can drive and have a conversation with someone, because driving can be automatic. Mm. But as soon as that car swerves in front of you, all of a sudden you stop talking and all of your attention goes on the car in front of you and you hit the brakes. So it's not possible for people to do two things that require effort. I can't be in a Zoom meeting and do my email at the same time. Right. What I'm actually doing is switching my attention. And so, you know, you brought up this idea of multitasking not being a good idea. It's a terrible idea. And the reason is that, first of all, people make more errors. That's been shown. In fact, there is a study shown that when physicians multitask, and you probably won't like to hear this, but they make more prescribing errors. Mm. We know that nurses make more errors, pilots make more errors, in laboratory studies, people make more errors. We also know that it takes longer to do any single task if you keep switching your attention away from it and coming back. And why? Because there's a certain amount of time that's involved to reorient back to the task. It's like we have an internal whiteboard in our minds and we're erasing it and then writing what we need to know for the new task, erasing that, writing what we need for the new task. And that creates what's called a switch cost. And probably the worst news of all about multitasking is that it makes people stress. It causes stress. So we know that. Blood pressure rises. There's a physiological marker in the body that indicates stress. In my research, where we had people wear heart rate monitors in the office, we saw a very strong correlation between people being stressed and switching their attention.
And yet, despite everything you just said, you say that we should not feel bad about these mindless activities that we switch to, like playing games or solving puzzles in the middle of tasks that we're trying to get done that are, in fact, important. That they are doing that is actually beneficial. Well, how so, given everything you just said?
Right. So this kind of what I call rote activity, this is where you're engaged with something, but it's not at all hard effort. This can be beneficial as a break if we do it strategically. So people have all kinds of things that they do for rote activity. People might knit, or, you know, I've heard people who say they have a ball and a screen that they throw it against. The philosopher Wittgenstein peeled potatoes and said he got his greatest ideas when he peeled potatoes. So it turns out our research shows that when people do these kind of very simple rote activities, it actually makes them happy. They're happiest when they do it. So it has a calming effect on people. And so I'm saying, yes, it's fine to take a break and to do these kinds of, you know, mindless activities to help get our mental resources replenished. Of course, the best break of all is to go outside, take a walk in nature. I live in California. I can do that easily. I realize in a lot of other places, circumstances don't allow people to simply go outside. Might be cold, snowy, and so on. But doing something simple and rote keeps the mind engaged. And you can let ideas incubate in the back of your mind. And then when you come back to your real hard work, you might see it with fresh eyes.
Well, taking a walk kind of refreshes you because you're completely out of the other environment, and you are in an environment that traditionally has been thought to, and usually does, lower your blood pressure and make you feel better. And it's healthy because you're breathing in fresh air. And it's part of what you say. One of your prescriptives is to take meaningful breaks. What yes. other, aside from taking a walk, what would be a meaningful break?
It's a lengthy break. It's enough to really get yourself relaxed and replenished. Walking around, doing exercise, you know, even if you don't go outside, being inside and moving around mm-hmm. is really a wonderful break. And in fact, in a recent study, and this was done before the pandemic, and this was using sensors, we studied 750 people across the US for an entire year. And we found 90% of their day office workers are sedentary, sitting down. That's not good. So it is important to move around and get exercise. When I talk about doing rote activity, I see it more as something that you can do as an interim. For example, if you have a meeting in 5 minutes or 10 minutes, it's okay to pull back. You know, maybe you just got out of a very tough meeting. So it's okay to pull back, do something calming, and then you can go back into your next tough meeting.
Your studies have shown that we should aim for a balance of attentional states that reflect our own circadian rhythms. I got to tell you, I'm puzzled about that. So explain what that means.
Right.
Because I associate circadian rhythms with sleep.
Yes. So first of all, let me say that we find that there are rhythms during the day when people are at their peak focus and when they're in their troughs. And it corresponds to how much attentional capacity or resources we have available. And people have different chronotypes. So you might be an early type or you might be a late type. I'm not an early type, even though right now it's yeah. coming on 7 o'clock in the morning. But the average peak time for most people is mid to late morning, and then they have another peak focus time mid to late afternoon. If you're an early type, your peak focus is much earlier. If you're yeah. a late type, it's going to be much later. And so it's important to become aware of what your peak focus time is. Know what your chronotype is.
How do you do that? How do you become aware of that?
Well, there are simple tests you can take. I think most people are somewhat aware of whether you're an early type or a late type. But you can also get in tune to when you start feeling exhausted. I have had my students do an exercise where they just keep a simple diary for a day, writing down what their level of mental energy is. And it's a way for them to determine what their peak focus times are. And so it's really important. And as we talked about earlier, you can't have extended periods of focus without getting exhausted. And so then it's important to be able to switch to a different kind of attention, do something more.
Can you change that? I mean, you started life as an artist, and artists kind of make their own schedules. You get up when you get up, you go to bed when you go to bed, and you work when you work. But most of us have a rigorous schedule. I have to be here behind this microphone at 9 o'clock every morning. And quite honestly, I would prefer to go to bed at 3 a.m. and get up at 11. That's my circadian rhythm, and I can't do it. So can we adopt to the requirements of life?
You know, it's tough. I think we can. You know, of course, if your natural chronotype doesn't match what your physical workplace requires, this of course, you know, it's a yeah. mismatch, and we just have to learn to deal with it. I will say though that I have studied teams who are doing remote work during the pandemic. And it turns out we see slippage into people's natural chronotypes. So when people are working from home, if you're an early type, you tend to wake up early and then you start sending messages to your colleagues. And then you have other people on the team who are late types and they get up later and they're not answering those messages. So we have less alignment among team members. And that people are doing what's natural for them in that case when they were working from home.
One of the suggestions that you have for us to fix some of these problems is to become more intentional about our actions and look at the reasons behind our behavior by asking things like, am I distracting myself because I'm bored? Will becoming distracted by social media, for instance, mean that you'll be up until midnight because you have a deadline to meet? So should you be paying attention to social media? How should the answers to those questions inform our behavior?
Yeah, so people can develop agency. And one of the ways is to make these unconscious activities, these automatic actions, to make them more conscious, to bring them into our conscious awareness. How do we do that? We can probe ourselves. So, and I've learned to do this. Of course, I'm an observer of human behavior, so it was easy for me to figure out how to observe myself. When I have an urge to check social media or check news, I'm a news junkie, I probe myself and I'll ask, do I really need to do that now? Why do I have to read the news right now? And it's usually because I'm bored, because the task is difficult, because I want to procrastinate. And by understanding the reasons, it helps keep me on track. Another thing you can practice is what's called forethought. And that's understanding how your current actions will impact your work later in the day. So if I have an urge to go on social media and I know I might spend a half hour, an hour on social media, I envision what my end of the day is going to look like at 10 p.m. Am I going to be feeling fulfilled that I completed my work that and I can sit back with reading a book, having a nice glass of wine, or am I still going to be working on that overdue report? So envisioning our future selves later in the day can help us keep on track currently.
I was reading an article yesterday in the New York Times, which featured you and another professor, perhaps you know her, she's a colleague at UCLA, Dr. Marianne Wolfe, a professor in residence there, who says that when we read things on screens are designed to make us read very quickly, to scroll, to skim, to scan, so that we have to sit down and read a book on paper. It is a different skills. We need to read things in print more slowly. And she suggests one way to regain our attention span is to engage in 20 minutes a day of deep reading material like your book on paper, even reading this book on a screen through one of those e-readers is not the same. Do you agree with that?
I do agree. I think it's really important to pull away from electronic media during the day and get ourselves used to reading books, magazines. So it is really important to give ourselves a break from, because we are conditioned with certain kinds of behavior when we're on screens. And so it's really important to get away from that for part of the day.
I have 15 seconds. We have a whole generation of young people who have never known life before the computer, before the internet, before smartphones. Can these techniques that you're suggesting in these books to regain attention span, can they work for them?
Yes, of course they can. Yes. And in fact, you know, young people they're agile. It's easy to change. So yes, of course, young people can change.
Dr. Gloria Mark, her book is called it's called Attention Span, Find Focus, Fight Distraction, a groundbreaking way to restore balance, happiness, and productivity. Thanks for the hour.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.